United States against Avil Sorozano. Ms. Roberts.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Ms. Romero. Good morning. I'm Jan Roberts from Durkin & Roberts, joined by my partner at counsel table for the appellant, Saria Avila Solorzano. I was appointed by the district court to represent Mr. Solorzano in February 2009 on an indictment that charged him with illegal reentry, cases that I know this court has had before it recently. Following a guilty plea on November 19, 2009, the court sentenced my client to 70 months incarceration. This is a direct appeal of that sentence. All of the issues we raised involve the application of 2L1.2 under the sentencing guidelines, under which the base offense level is 8. The pre-sentence investigation found that Mr. Solorzano had multiple, I believe it was at least 3 DUI convictions, coupled with obstruction of justice convictions because he was found carrying false identification, all in the Circuit Court of DuPage County, 1 aggravated DUI, and those all were between 1999 and 2006. Additionally, there was a 2006 conviction for theft and aggravated battery in a public place, also in the Circuit Court of Cook County, and that is the conviction that formed the basis of all 3 issues, and certainly now 2 left before the court.
Now, Ms. Roberts, you argue in your brief that the court shouldn't have relied on the PSR to determine the underlying offense. But do you contest the accuracy of the PSR regarding the language of the indictment for aggravated battery?
Well, I don't contest nor do I concede the accuracy, since there were no underlying documents attached, and as in the case most recently, in fact, the case decided by this court after my opening brief was filed, but before the government filed their brief, Rodriguez-Gomez, in at least in that case, the government's version of the offense ostensibly or purportedly quoted directly from the charge in the state court. And as I understand it from the opinion, counsel on appeal conceded that the plea of guilty in the circuit court in that case was under the first prong of the battery statute.
In that case, conceded that he didn't have a clue whether it had been under subsection 1 or subsection 2, but he conceded to the facts that appeared to bring it within subsection 1.
Well,
and a member of the panel in that case then asked the defense lawyer, your predecessor, the same question I'm now going to ask you, which is, did you go get a copy of the indictment or the judgment of conviction to see what it was that your client was convicted of?
Well, no, I did not, Judge. No, I did not.
Exactly what your predecessor said. And, of course, then the opinion in Rodriguez-Gomez said, well, given that the statute is divisible and given that the facts seem to bring it within the aggravated form, and given that we don't know it was undercharged, it's hard to say the district court made a plain error. Don't we have the same problem here?
Well, in Rodriguez-Gomez, you discussed 2 things. You discussed first whether the issue had been waived. And there is no way that I believe that the record in this case would support, nor did I.
You didn't find waiver in Rodriguez-Gomez either.
Right. You found that it was forfeited.
Just use the plain error doctrine.
Right. And so you used plain error. I do not read that opinion to put the onus on the defendant to find the supporting documentation.
There's no question of onus. But what we said in both Rodriguez-Gomez and United States against Ramirez is that the defendant may not have a burden to bring in the documents, but if you don't make an argument in the district court, the appellate standard of review is plain error. And on plain error review, the onus is certainly on the accused. Right? That's one big difference between plain error review and review of a preserved claim of error.
Well, Judge, I certainly argued vociferously, I believe, before Judge St. Eve, not just the fast-track issue, not just that that 2L1.1, you could not find a crime of violence when what it was a simple battery, aggravated, and a misdemeanor that was only became a felony and therefore could be considered by the court based upon the aggravator of standing on a sidewalk. It only was permissible to consider that case based upon the fact that the victim purportedly was standing on a sidewalk. The charge was aggravated battery on a public way. But the pre-sentence investigation only talks about what the indictment charged. There is nothing in the PSI to indicate he certainly was convicted of something. It says on page 9 of the PSI.
How do you distinguish your case from Rodriguez-Gomez, where the judgment of conviction was not in the record? All that was in the PSR was a statement about the facts about what had happened. We inferred from the facts that the conviction must have been under sub 1 because that's what matched the facts in the PSR. And this sounds pretty much like a replay.
I think Rodriguez-Gomez is distinguishable, Judge. In that case, Judge Bauer found that
the Court of Appeals made a decision.
I'm sorry. The Court of Appeals found that attached to the PSR was a copy of the government's submission to the probation officer, which included the following quotation from the state court indictment. Okay? That is not the case here. Neither the PSR at page 9 quotes from the charge, it's a paraphrase, nor the government's version. The government's version, I would point out, simply says, and I quote, defendant should also receive the 16-point enhancement for the special offense characteristic of a conviction of a violent crime. It doesn't even refer to the particular crime upon which the government would have claimed the 16-level enhancement should apply.
So are you arguing that the paraphrase is inaccurate or that it's ambiguous?
I think it's ambiguous, Judge.
What's the ambiguity?
Because the paraphrase from the government's perspective only refers to a special offense characteristic of a conviction of a violent crime, and the whole issue was whether...
I'm sorry, what is the ambiguity in the paraphrase?
The ambiguity in that paraphrase is it doesn't even refer to the particular crime in his prior criminal history. And it's not really an ambiguity in the PSR. The PSR, however, only refers to what the indictment charged and that he pled guilty to something. With enough state court experience, one understands that pleas are negotiated in state court frequently for lesser offenses. It is impossible to tell from this whether he pled guilty to the two counts in that indictment, whether he pled guilty to the aggravated battery the factual basis consisted of the first prong of the battery statute. It's impossible to tell whether he pled guilty solely to count two, the theft count. And I do not think that the district court, could have resolved that. And I think the district court knew, because in the discussion, albeit it was very short, the court initially came out and said she had decided that issue against me, that she had done her own research. And reading from her comments, she relies on an unpublished opinion by this court, as well as the Thigpen opinion, which clearly cites to Shepherd. She clearly understood that there were only a certain number of documents from the state court that she could be relying on, and yet they were not present in the record. I see I'm into my time, and I would like to reserve the last minute for rebuttal.
Ms. Romero.
May it please the Court, my name is Jessica Romero, and I represent the appellee, the United States. I'll briefly respond to a couple of points made by defense counsel. With respect to the first one, there is no ambiguity as set forth in the PSR when it recites the language of the state court indictment that the defendant was convicted under a subsection 1 battery conviction.
Did the PSR quote the indictment? I thought it summarized it.
Yep.
It's correct. It does not contain quotation marks.
It summarizes it. Perfectly normal behavior for prosecutors to charge an offense that is less serious than the maximum one that could be charged, right? If you know that a defendant was caught with 50 grams of crack cocaine, it's possible he was charged only with personal possession. He may have been charged and convicted with distribution. If you really want to know what he was convicted of, you've got to get the record of conviction. Why is it that we have so many cases where the prosecutor didn't bother to get the record of conviction?
Your Honor, I think it turns on the fact that it was never contested that the PSR recites the indictment and that the defendant pled guilty. And as a result, there's no further inquiry into the matter before the district court.
Pled guilty to both counts?
The conviction indicates, as set forth in the PSR, it does not indicate whether he pled guilty to counts 1 and 2, but the conviction says specifically it was theft and aggravated battery. Accordingly, those were counts 1 and 2 of the state court indictment.
And where is that said? That's what he pleaded guilty to, both counts?
As I said, it doesn't say the PSR does not set forth he pled guilty to counts 1 and 2, but it says he pled guilty and that the conviction is for theft and aggravated battery, which were the two separate charges identified in the indictment.
So that is part of the summary?
That's correct.
But well, no, that's part of the summary. That's a separate finding by the probation officer, presumably. That's not the indictment doesn't have the conviction.
That's correct.
You're saying you've got the summary of the indictment and then the statement by the probation officer that he pleaded guilty both to theft and to aggravated battery.
It says
and then you tie them back to these two summary paragraphs.
That is correct, Your Honor. There is an inference between the information that summarized about the indictment and what the plea of guilty was and what the specific convictions were.
If no party was in actual possession of the state court indictment to ensure the reliability of the PSR summary, then shouldn't this case be remanded to obtain that document at the very least?
No, Your Honor. I can think of two reasons. The first is the defendant did not contest the information in the PSR as being unreliable, and as the record is now, it's not contradicted by any information whatsoever. The district court properly relied on the PSR in order to make its determination. And second of all, to this day, there is no information, even outside the record, that's been proffered by defense counsel that would contradict the reliability of the information contained in the PSR.
You know, in Rodriguez-Gomez, the PSR actually quoted the state indictment, and the court noted that defendant's appointed counsel had received the charging document, had waived any argument that the first prong of the battery offense was the basis for the conviction. So, I mean, isn't that a much more compelling case than this one?
I think it's a different case, but I don't think necessarily it dictates the outcome that there's an incorrect – it does not dictate that there's an incorrect outcome in this case or that somehow factually the information contained in the PSR is not accurate and was improperly relied upon at the district court level. The fact remains the indictment plainly sets forth that he was charged under subsection A1 and that he was convicted for aggravated battery and theft, which was the other allegation contained in the indictment. The district court was not asked to decide the issue of whether the information contained in the PSR was accurate or not. And when it relied on the findings in the PSR, that specifically the fact that the defendant had pled guilty, those were the admissions that it was referring to in connection with its findings. If there are no further questions, yes, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. Thank you,
all
counsel.
Right.
Thank you. We ask that the district court be affirmed.
Ms. Roberts, we'll give you 30 seconds for rebuttal.
Thank you very much. I understand the concern that defense counsel, I, did not come forward with the documentation. The probation officer never questioned whether there was documentation. The government didn't submit it, and the judge, even referring to this court's Thigpen opinion, did not. In fact, she made reference to the underlying state court documents herself, even though there were none. It results in a 40-month differential in the sentencing for my client between an 8-level bump and 16. And I think it is fundamentally unfair to find that because I did not.
Thank you. And Ms. Roberts, we appreciate your willingness to accept the appointment in this case and your assistance to the court as well as your client. The case is taken under advisement.